in shorthand, money is the opposite of culture. Money is the first value that gets to you, unless you've got culture to stave it off.
One of the strongest impressions of the author in this book is of his ecstatic disgust. Would you say you suffer from disgust?
I think every writer actually loves it all.
And you walk towards it rather than turning away.
I'm fascinated in distortions and distempers. I don't sit around feeling disgusted at all. I feel enthused.
Feels like quite a special honour to have been invited once again into the living room of an author who I've been introduced to through the novelist Jonathan Coe. Graham Caveney is the writer I'm speaking to on this episode, the episode being about Martin Amis's magnum opus, released 40 years ago this year, Money, A Suicide Note. First of all, Graham, how are you doing?
I'm okay, Jack. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
We've been going back and forth for a while about how you're view of this novel in particular has changed. I think it's wise for you to tell us where you were in your life when you first picked up the novel.
I first read this in paperback in 1985. I was halfway through a degree in English and American literature at Warwick University, a degree I wasn't particularly enjoying. I wanted to be a writer, and I kind of figured that doing a degree in English would be serving an apprenticeship, but actually it was a series of survey courses, which I just didn't connect with. It felt like we were doing literature in the way American tourists did Europe. We were just sort of Paris one day and then Belgium, Brussels the next or whatever. And I just wasn't, the literature wasn't speaking to me. They may well have been my immaturity, I'm sure it was. But one of the tutors on the course was Jonathan Coe, who was at that point writing a PhD on Henry Fielding. And when I told him I was thinking of leaving, he just kept saying, well, there are still books to be read that are not on the course. And he started to kind of put books my way, like Alistair Gray and I think Anita Bruckner's Hotel du Lac and Julian Boynes's Flaubert's Parrot. And I don't think he actually lent me money, but because I was part of this kind of exchange of contemporary fiction, I picked up money. And it felt like listening to The Clash's first album for the first time. It was just this astonishing, iconoclastic swagger, this transatlantic drawl that unsettled me. I wasn't quite sure. I read it, and then I turned to the first page, and I just thought, I just read it again, which I very rarely did, and indeed do.
What inspired you to read it again the second time? You said there that you were unsettled.
Yeah, the sheer audacity of the sentences, the verbal gymnastics, the somersaults, the compound words, the voice. I know Amis would later go on and worry. He said that when he handed the novel in, he worried that he'd written this book that was pure voice, but that was actually what appealed to me. And as you know, I've been rereading the critic James Wood, and his essay on Amis starts with the insight, which was borne out by my experience, that from about 1945, there seemed to be a treaty that English novels could not be interesting for the next 30 years. It just was this arid kind of landscape. There were exceptions like V.S. Naipaul. But on the whole, as someone who was trying to find their own voice, trying to find the readers and the writers who I could connect with as a 20-year-old man at that point, England was not the place to find them, which is why I did English and American literature, because it seemed to me, and I think to Amis and lots of people my generation, that really the novel belonged to America after the Second World War. Mailer, Updike, Roth, Toni Morrison, a whole kind of new voice, not of modernism, but a modern voice, one that was able to kind of address the dizzying vertiginous world of post-war, the post-war world. And the Brits just weren't doing it. The Brits just couldn't do it. And so there was this vacuum, and it felt like even that I was doing English and American literature, and here was an English writer who was writing American, he just filled that void. And it was the first book of his I'd read. I don't know why I'd not read the others. So I went back and just devoured the other books. But because Money was my first one, Money was the one that was dearest to my heart. And I bought several copies and distributed them around. And I mean, this is about the ninth copy I've bought, seriously, because...
I can see it. It's a modern copy there. Yeah, yeah. Not the original polished Money typography.
Urban excess.
That's right.
Yes.
So you reread it. What, after that second reading, do you remember feeling?
It's now possible to write about the contemporary moment. You don't have to either write some kind of dystopian futurist stuff, or you don't have to be enslaved to the past, to heritage. It was like the clash in that sense.
Like you say, one of those big cultural moments.
Yeah.
Permission to try new things.
Yes, yeah. And at that point, like I say, I wanted to be a writer. And the only outlet it occurred to me that I could write at that age, 1920, was the music press. So I started sending off reviews to the music press, quite a few of which got published. And I started writing, being a book reviewer for the NME, which then launched me into a different world. But it was really sort of reading Amis and then Julian Barnes and realising that, you know what, this isn't the province of V.S. Pritchett or of the Oxbridge guys. I know that they are Oxbridge, but they didn't feel it somehow. They didn't carry around that anxiety of influence, that great phrase of Harold Bloom's, you know. They felt like Jagger and Richards. I mean, you know, I'm... blush slightly to think of that now. But they really felt as though they opened up the door to this contemporary voice, which I thought had belonged to the Americans, basically. Because the other big book was that New Journalism collection for me. With Didion and Mailer and Capote and all those people. So I thought that was possible if you were American. Or I thought if you were a Brit, you were trapped with kind of William Golding or something. It just never... I thought, this isn't my world. And Amis was, in ways I'm probably still unpacking. You know, I think a lot of our generation, my generation, probably felt that in the same way we felt that with punk, that you can spend the rest of your life just kind of potentially frozen in a moment. But hopefully not. Hopefully sort of it then thaws out. And the thing about punk, the most interesting thing about punk was post-punk, in terms of if you want to kind of carry that metaphor on. And I think that was probably true in some ways with Amis as well. The writers who came afterward, I've got Jeff Dyer in my head. You could hear that Jeff Dyer was, okay, he's absorbed Amis. He's... digested it. He's moving on, and I think you've got to do that.
Money was published in 1984, but I believe it's set in 1981. You have very different feelings about this novel now. I think in order to really unpack that, we need to go back to what you remember of the time that Amis is writing about through the eyes of his protagonist, John Self.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm one of the through lines of Money. It's not plot heavy at all, but one of the through lines is the wedding of Princess Di and Charles. So I remember clearly being opposed to that in the way that young men of my generation were. But mainly I remember this explosion that had happened called Thatcherism, the early days of that, although we probably didn't call it Thatcherism then. We just called it... A whole lexicon was being born at that point. In retrospect, it was probably best known as neoliberalism. But it felt full of potent and dread and possibility and excitement. And those things were kind of coexisting. with a kind of uneasy alliance. The idea of a collective world, of trade unions, of dreary things like a welfare state, were slowly being called in, not slowly, quite rapidly. It was becoming clear that those belong to a bygone age. So, and I was 17 in 1981. So I was the right age to be both a victor of that and also the vanquished of that. And a few years later, when Thatcherism really took hold, she introduced things like the Enterprise Allowance Scheme, and I was able to set up on as a freelance writer on that, which was ironic because everyone I knew who was on the Enterprise Allowance Scheme was vehemently anti-Thatcher. And yet we were all taking this 50 quid a week, and we were all kind of, there were stand-up comedians, there were rock bands, there were puppet troops, the radical theatres, all taking the Thatcher dime.
But you had reason to be opposed, because what she was also doing was closing the humanities department, cracking down on things that didn't have direct economic potential to grow GDP, which in the book is hinted at a lot through John Self, who is wrestling always with this sense that he wants to, as he puts it, break out of the world of money and into the realm of thought and fascination. But as a working class lad done good in Thatcher's world, he doesn't know the way.
Yeah.
I suspect you couldn't relate to him at all.
Well, I came from the industrial north that was no longer mighty or industrial. It was post-industrial, and that's always a phrase that gets followed by the word decline. So this small mill town in the north of Accrington, which had once been the centre of King Cotton, and once that had gone, it was replaced by nothing, not even service industries. So I knew the working class. What I didn't know was the working class who were entrepreneurial. My working class were, you did the jobs that your dad did, and you stayed in this small community, and it was all very community focused. My mother and father were at school together. They didn't really leave a 4 mile radius. So the shock of the Thatcher revolution was to give people from that kind of background, my kind of background, just obscene amounts of money, which we hadn't earned or we hadn't inherited. I'm not saying me, but you know, people around me. And the chance, was it the same year that the Pet Shop Boys released Opportunities?
I think so.
I mean, you know, there couldn't be a finer soundtrack to this. And you didn't need, I remember on Monday mornings, The Guardian used to do adverts for job adverts. And it was always creative media and marketing, as though they were the same thing. And really, that was just a very broad church for anyone who felt they could be on the make a bit. And of course, there was lots of push by it. There was the miners' strike in 84. There was Greenham Common. There was lots of outrage about what Thatcher was doing. There were about 3 million unemployed. I remember my dad saying, if there's more than 1 million unemployed in this country, there'll be a revolution. That was in the 70s. There's 3 million unemployed. And, of course, people were taken to the streets. There were riots. And there was no shortage of people writing about this. What was unique from my point of view was to read somebody who created an embodiment of it. This grotesque embodiment that was almost a celebration. It sucked you in because you were laughing with as well as at. It was a real uncertain, disconcerting kind of laughter. Not quite farce, not quite satire, certainly burlesque, vaudevillian, something of Hogarth meets a Viz comic.
That's a brilliant description. Do you ever remember meeting anyone in the 80s who reminded you of John Self? When you picture him in your mind, what does he look like?
He looks like Robbie Coltrane. I thought the very bad film that had, was it Mel Smith who was in the film?
Yes.
I didn't really think worked. If it had been Robbie Coltrane, I think it would have been a winner, really. But you'd see them. I used to go to London to the Enemy offices or later the Face or whatever, and you would actually see City Boys, loud, yobbish, in your face, waving their wands. I mean, on TV, there was a comedian, Harry Enfield's early character, Loads of Money. And it became, Enfield's idea was obviously a pantomime, but it became a very real chant. It was an extraordinary outpouring of the very worst elements of masculinity, what John Self embodies. I mean, I couldn't imagine this book being written there, let alone published.
When you mentioned earlier how Amis submitted the manuscript, worried that this novel was going to be pure voice, I mean, it is largely voice, but then again, it is pure self, pure John Self, the ego, the narcissistic drive to sate all appetites. And of course, he's always appealing to the reader to question their own motivations. And what about you? How's it working out for you?
Brother, sister.
Yeah, that Christian appeal from the pulpit of the slovenliness in which he lives. Anyway, rereading it in 2024, 40 years after it was published, what are your thoughts now?
Well, I think there's a story told about money, which is similar to the one that I've told, that there's the publication inspired a whole generation of intense young men with trembling hands to smoke roll-ups and speak in a transatlantic drawl, and that excluded women. And 40 years, we look back post-Me Too and go, oh dear, what have we done? I can see why that story has traction, but I just don't quite buy it. And looking back, I've been struck by the similarities between this book and Andrea Dworkin's work, which has never occurred to me. You know, her books on pornography and her books on intercourse, in which she talks about basically all male intercourse is rape. I mean, it's an extraordinary polemic, this sustained polemic. And I've always thought of them as kind of opposite ends of the spectrum, as it were. But actually, there's a really kind of strange dovetailing of these two voices that have been going through my head. You asked me to come up with some reading, some passages that you'd like me to read. And I struggled to find, to begin with, a passage that didn't have a rape joke. And that troubled me. I don't want to, you know, be overly censorious about this. Amis is not John Self, and this is a work of fiction, and I don't have any problems with fiction going where it needs to go. But as a 21st century reader, it is odd now to read this and to think how troubled was I by this stuff at the time. I remember the passage where he talks about hitting women. John Self talks about hitting women. How easy it is once you've done it a couple of times.
I think that was the most uncomfortable moment for me of the whole book. When he's struggling to be a better man and knows that he is failing, you warm to him. But when he says that, that's when the nastiness comes out in a way that made me think, oof, I'm not sure we're going to get on here.
Yeah, it's clearly the climate that we're currently reading in, isn't it? One of the thoughts that went through my head is John Self is now running for president of the United States. This joke isn't funny anymore. At one point in the 80s, you could have comedians like Jerry Sadovitz, who just kind of clearly was being some kind of exorcism of all the political correctness that he saw in comedy like Ben Elton or whatever, and was just allowing himself to... He was almost crucifying himself as this sort of Dorian Gray figure. I am the repressed. I am this outpouring of everything that you secretly think but dare never say. And I think there was something of that here. But it... There was always that sense of, well, it's that's not really us. We're able to close the book. We're able to move on and read some of the other fascinating writers at the time, Alistair Gray and James Kelman and Anita Bruckner. And reading it now, it feels like you reach the limits of irony. You reach... this point where nothing quite dates like comedy as well. I don't want to particularly accuse Amos of anything that his characters are guilty of. And that negotiation, I think, is something that played him really unfairly throughout his career, that conflation of the world that he described and the person that he was. From what I gather, he was couldn't be further from that. And I've been watching a lot of YouTube interviews with him, and he's so measured and considered in his answers and so thoughtful. But it is just shocking as a 21st century reader. It probably says more about how we're conditioned to read now than it does about anything else, or it says as much about that.
You mentioned there was a passage there that you managed to find that wasn't the most abject example of misogyny. Perhaps we can go into that.
I like to think of my West London flat as a kind of playboy pad. This has no effect on my flat, which remains a gaff, a lair, a lean-to, a sock. It smells of batch, of bachelordom. Even I can nose it. Don't let batch into your life, into your bones. After a while, batch gets into your bones. Like an adolescent, throbbing, gaping, my poor flat pines for a female presence, and so do I. His spirit is broken, and so is mine. My pad has tussled cream carpets, a rhino and pylon sofa, and an oval bed with black satin counterpane. None of this is mine. The voile walls are not mine. I hire everything. I hire water, heat, light. I hire tea by the teabag. I've lived here for 10 years now, and nothing is mine. My flat is small and also cost me lots of money. Standing in the Nordic nook of the kitchen, I can gaze down at the flimsy-limbed joggers heading south towards the park. It's nearly as bad as New York. Some of these gasping fatzos, these too little too late artists, they look as though they're running up rising ground, climbing ground. My generation, we started all this. Before, everyone was presumably content to feel like death the whole time. Now they want to feel terrific forever. The 60s taught us this, that it was hateful to be old. I am a product of the 60s, an obedient, unsmiling, no-comment product of the 60s. But in this matter, my true sympathies go further back, to those days of yore when no one minded feeling like death the whole time. I peer through the spectral, polluted, nicotine-sodden windows of my sock at these old lollopers in their kiddie gear. Go home, I say. Go home, lie down, and eat lots of potatoes. I had 3 hand jobs yesterday. None was easy. Sometimes you really have to buckle down to it, as you do with all forms of exercise. It's simply a question of willpower. Anyone who's got the balls to stand there and tell me their hand job isn't exercise just doesn't know what he's talking about. I almost had a heart attack during number 3. I take all kinds of other exercise too. I walk up and down the stairs, I climb into cabs and restaurant booths, I hike to the Butcher's Arms and the London Apprentice, I cough a lot, I throw up pretty frequently, which really takes it out of you. I sneeze and hit the tub and the can. I get in and out of bed, often several times a day.
One of the guests that you'd listened to on this podcast, Alice Denby, said on the episode in which we spoke about the novel Success that it's always been assumed that women won't enjoy Martin Amis, or that men feel the need to put themselves out in front to protect them from it and just warn them that there are many things there that they're going to read that they're not going to like, that absolutely is not a reflection on all men and certainly not myself, etc., etc.
Yeah.
But that she says it's perfectly possible for a woman to read a novel like Money and really enjoy it, A, and B, understand where the flaws in the character are meant to be explicitly their flaws and not some sort of endorsement of a worldview. In contrast, you said the novel left you cringing. Is there a very particular experience as a male Martin Amis reader, because men know men like John Self, that this is much less to do with how men relate to women, but how men relate to other men?
And the John Self in their self. I think that is the real crux of the matter. I was delighted to hear Alice say what she said, actually. I was really intrigued by that interview. I think one way of answering this, Jack, is to say that in the 80s, the critical consensus on the liberal progressive left, let's call it, was that in order for a feminist film or book to be called that, it didn't have to show strong women doing progressive things or being particularly feminist. What it needed to do was to lay bare the conditions that illustrated how women were oppressed. And in so doing, was an implicit call to some kind of emancipatory thought, practice, politics. And what seems to have happened over the last 40 years is that we want a kind of culture of the superego, by which I mean that we don't want films and novels to show these things anymore. We want films and novels to show how people are overcoming them. And we want narratives of triumph and escape and victory and empowerment, which are fine, but those are all narratives that happen on an individual level. You know, not everyone can be a success by definition. Some people have to fail. And that seems to me a complete 360 as a sort of trajectory of what counts for a progressive reading. And I kind of forget that that's where we are. I often think, in many ways, Amis and Roth should be gifts to, and used to be in some ways, gifts to feminist readings. This is what men are like. This is the utter bathos of masculinity. It's neediness, it's infantilism, it's, at best, it's kind of aspiring to adolescence. Look, this is our gift to you. And now that's not, that gift is maybe understandably no longer being gratefully received. The pushback seems to be, we don't care anymore.
I think one of the things that Amis reinforced in the way that he spoke about his portrayal of men was that he felt that there were hard limits to what the average man is able to achieve in terms of self-improvement.
And in a wider context, Amis, I think, got folded into what became known as the New Lad. So you had Loaded magazine and you had GQ and I was writing for GQ, so I knew this kind of first
hand. Right, okay.
This way of renegotiating masculinity that men, some men felt, we've been castrated by feminism. We're on board with it to some extent, but we feel that male heterosexual desire has been lost. And so we're going to try and sort of rebalance this by playful and ironic embracing of football, drinking, tits and arse. Again, enter Amis is a few years before this. So, you know, he's kind of called on board by the James Brown Loaded generation as kind of, oh, he's the kind of laureate of this New Laddish aesthetic. But I don't... Everyone has their great subject, right? Henry James was Europe and America, Anita Bruckner, Exile, and Amis's great subject. I don't think he ever really recovered from, the reason I chose that was the 60s. That's the reason I chose that that passage, and particularly the sexual revolution of the 60s. He was both a victim of it and also... He benefited from it massively whilst being utterly baffled by it.
Do you think Money is arguably a book about the 60s more than it is about the 80s?
Yeah, it's about a generation who come of age in the 80s, who were born in the 60s and carry around this kind of inheritance that they're still unpacking. They don't quite understand what it is. There's a gratitude, a deep gratitude to the 60s in Amis. Imagine what it gave us. Imagine what I didn't have to go to war. I got all the benefits of Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and LSD and all those eye-opening moments and a free education and a free NHS and a world in which everything seemed to be going my way and was always going to get better. So why do I feel so fucking awful? Was the question behind Amos, I think.
And it's the question behind John's self too, isn't it? Yeah, when he talks about the world he's seeing now in the 80s as a man who's just turned 35, I think, in the novel.
That's right.
He says the queue to the dole starts at the exit from the school. Sometimes when we talk about 2024 and the 2020s in general, we'd say, oh, the 80s was a boom period. But he's already talking about the fact that the losers there are right out on the street. You know, the sponge, as he calls it, of upended suitcases and mattresses, going to downtown New York, walking through Harlem, the rich and poor housed as close as two faces of a knife.
Yeah, let me have a look. My head is a city. And various pains have now taken up residence in various parts of my face. A gum and bone ache has launched a cooperative on my Upper West Side. Across the park, neuralgia has rented a duplex in my fashionable East 70s. Downtown, my chin throbs with lofts of jaw loss. As for my brain, my hundreds, it's Harlem up there, expanding in the summer fires. It boils and swells. One day soon, it is going to burst. Memory's a funny thing, isn't it? You don't agree? I don't agree either. Memory has never amused me much, and I find its tricks more and more wearisome as I grow older. Perhaps memory simply stays the same, but has less work to do as the days fill out. My memory's in good shape, I think. It's just that my life is getting less memorable all the time. Can you remember where you left those keys? Why should you? Lying in the tub some slow afternoon, can you remember if you've washed your toes? Taking a leak is boring, isn't it, after the first few thousand times? Isn't that a drag? I can't remember half the stuff I do anymore, but then I don't want too much. Waking now at noon, for example, I have a strong sense that I spoke to Selena in the night. It would be just like her to haunt me during the black hours when I am weak and scared. Selena knows something that everyone ought to know by now. She knows that people are easy to frighten and haunt. People are easy to terrify. Me too, and I'm braver than most, or drunker anyway. And it's that thing of anxiety and affluence, the great sociologist of the 1950s, where America has never had it so good. Virtually full employment. Hell, all the signifiers of success are in place. So where is it? What's the thing? What's the hook that will complete this? And in its absence, why is it pulling everything else around it into disarray and meaninglessness? It seems to me that what Amos is really good at is not being a particularly rigorous philosopher, but being interested in enough in philosophy to kind of want to ask that question and answer it in fiction. So his novels pose these grand philosophical questions, which he then answers in a different sphere, in a different genre entirely. And I think that's exciting. He's not like Iris Murdoch, a philosopher who poses intellectual, philosophical questions and then answers them as a philosopher. You know, that's where he's narrowed. That's where the poet in him comes out. That's when the lover of sentences comes out. And that's where the meaning is, even whilst the meaning is groping towards a certain kind of nihilistic despair, I think. But I think that if you keep on scratching beneath the surface of these astonishing somersaults, these semantic aerobics that he does, I think you find there's actually an old-fashioned humanist in Amos who believes that women will redeem you and that somehow either Selena Street or Martina Twain, these women who hold out the promise of somehow regular life, whatever that is.
Yeah. Very much an idea that I think Martin Amos, from his generational perspective, held to. I think that's definitely something that's dated.
I mean, I think there's another conflation there as well, I think, which is that it's not just women who are redemptive, it's women, cultured women, women as culture, and culture as feminizing as well.
Right, yes.
Somehow opera, when he goes, John Self, there's a wonderful episode where John Self goes to see Othello, the opera.
With the burning cannonball on his lap.
Yeah, that's
needing
right.
Needing to take a piss.
He doesn't realise until Martina tells him afterwards that actually, you know, Desdemona has not been unfaithful. Oh, really? He's alarmed by that. And of course, the various novels, the two novels, is it, that Martina lends in, both Orwell? Mm. Is that right? That somehow a parody of that version of that I was brought up with, really, that if the F or leave this view of the world, that in the absence of God and the absence of those firm structures that we had in the Victorian world, we have what Matthew Arnold calls spilt religion, that books are improving and they will kind of do the emotional work and also the moral work. They will teach us how to live and there will be life lessons, that sort of thing. And that was very much how English literature was taught post-war. I mean, I was brought up with that version. If you want to understand life, read Lawrence. That was the thing. And if you want to understand politics, read Orwell. And if you want to understand how clear prose works, read Orwell. A certain kind of commonsensicality to him, but also unpredictability. But, you know, he was essentially sort of Britain is, or the Brits are socialist at their core, that socialism really is just common decency that the British, if they're allowed to, will get on with. And of course, Orwell's famous 1984, this sort of dystopian horror bit. And this in 1984, where it's not the state who has control, it's the lack of a state.
No, absolutely. It's the Huxley-Orwell dichotomy,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And that Huxley was more on the money, no pun intended, than Orwell. John Self, yeah. He is trapped, not in a totalitarian state, but a totalizing market.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Where hedonism is the empty currency, the devalued, debased currency.
And he wants to break out of it. But
yeah.
He can't. To me, this is what makes the novel so important even today. Because as you mentioned at the very beginning, what you lived through in the early 80s was the start of neoliberalism. And we are living with the full fallout of all of that now. And so revisiting this novel, I think, is always a chance to understand the morbidities as they were becoming more apparent.
After all that kind of unsettlement that I described, a kind of wow, he got away with that, and the strangeness of the 21st century. I then reread James Wood's essay on him, and Wood has got really interesting things to say about how Amos's talent is often in danger of punching down a bit too much, that he squanders some of his comic gifts with the easy cartoon when it could be so much bolder. And I think that was running through my head this time, that actually the book isn't as tightly structured. It's not really got a plot to it at all. I'd not realised that when I first read it, because I was so entranced by the voice. I didn't mind that. I just went with it. But actually there was an experience that I'd never had with Amos before, which was one of impatience. Towards, I was thinking, oh, come on, you know, not again. We're... And the thing that Wood says about being imprisoned, I think the essay is called Imprisoned Sensibility or something. And I can see how, in the same way that John Self is imprisoned by precisely the things you talked about, Amos then becomes imprisoned in the way in which he talks about them. So there's a kind of stylistic mirroring of irony doing to the prose what money is doing to John Self, that neither of them can quite find a way out of it.
Yeah.
Once Amos has settled on this note that really it's one just very dark gag that just gets pushed further and further, and let's really kind of run with this, from hitting women to rape to, you know, really let's dig deep with this one. He's painted himself into a corner. Where else can you go? You can't then say, but you know what, we should all just really kind of love each other and get along and find a, you know, because he's gone too far. He's already in this Hubert Selby, The Room type world, if you know that book, of just hell. And you think, well, anything, any resolution, any kind of glimmer of optimism is now going to fall flat. I don't feel uplifted by anything. Any way out is not going to feel like a way out because by definition, you've painted it as being a totalizing system.
Do you think this is why Martin Amis inserts himself into the novel?
Yeah. I think that's right. Answering that by American Psycho, the only way in which Ellis seems to get out of it are these strange moments where he talks about rock bands. Do you remember that? He says, oh, Genesis's first album is an interesting...
Yes.
And you're so relieved that there's a kind of break and suddenly you step back and you think, oh, this isn't real. This is some bizarre kind of fantasy that's taking place in the head of Patrick Bateman. When you read, oh, he's playing chess with Martin Amis, suddenly it's this jolt where the mirrors are all shattered. Because for 1 minute you're in this kind of hellish hall of mirrors. Wherever you look, he's just reflected back at you. Grotesque versions of yourself, John's self, the male self. And it all just becomes this kind of tempestuous, moronic inferno, you know? And then suddenly enter a chess match with the author. And you think, oh, right, actually, we're in the world of Nabokov. And it does kind of break the tension. But I think it then... It breaks the novel's jeopardy as well, I think. So I don't know if it's a successful novel in its own terms because of that. I don't know how rigorously it was edited. I don't know if at that point no one dare edit Amis.
Fascinating question. I mean, I know that famously Iris Murdoch didn't allow her novels to be edited. I would love to know how much editing there was of a novel like Money, because as you say, stylistically, it is so idiosyncratic. But I think that we spoke about the last reading you wanted to do for this being at the very, very beginning, not in the voice of John Self, but actually in the voice of the author, which is the prelude to Money. Yeah.
This is a suicide note. By the time you laid aside, and you should always read these things slowly on the lookout for clues or giveaways, John Self will no longer exist. Or at any rate, that's the idea. You never can tell, though, with suicide notes, can you? In the planetary aggregate of all life, there are many more suicide notes than there are suicides. They're like poems in that respect, suicide notes. Nearly everyone tries their hand at them sometime, with or without the talent. We all write them in our heads. Usually the note is the thing. You complete it and then resume your time travel. It is the note and not the life that is cancelled out. Or the other way round, or death. You never can tell, though, can you, with suicide notes? To whom is the note addressed? To Martina, to Fielding, to Vera, to Alec, to Selena, to Barry, to John Self? No, it is meant for you out there, the dear, the gentle.
Graham Caveney, thank you very much for appearing on this episode of My Martin Amis.
Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Jeff.